This is Father David Nix, Padre Peregrino Podcast, and tonight's podcast is called Catholic Healthcare Workers on COVID-19. I'm joined by two good friends in real life, Matt and Jill, one in my home state here, and the other Skyping in from a coast. Matt and Jill, thanks for joining me tonight.
Thank you, Father David.
So on tonight's podcast, we're simply going to put forth the symptoms and the treatments of coronavirus into layman's terms. The numbers for this disease are still very, very low. So none of what we're going to discuss tonight, it's neither to promote fear-mongering of how bad this disease is, or on the other side of the spectrum, it's not to say it's a government hoax where there's absolutely no danger at all. But it's even not a podcast tonight to really become super ethical where we're just going to follow up every conversation on the symptoms and treatments of COVID and say, oh, so make sure you wash your hands or make sure to lock yourself in your home. Tonight's podcast is really just to put into layman's terms with two medical professionals on the front lines of this COVID thing, the good news and the bad news both, the good news and the bad news of COVID, and really is essentially what the patients who've caught it are going to have to face, what they're going through, symptoms and treatments. So Matt is a physician and Jill is a registered nurse, and you guys are both really good because you guys always call me by my title. Matt, you call me Padre. And I think, Jill, you and Beth always called me FD, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'd like to say Dr. Matthew and Nurse Jillian, but, you know, that always rolls off the tongue better with a doctor, because I don't know about you, Jill, but whenever I hear a nurse in front of someone's name who's a nurse, it starts to sound like the evil nurse Ratchet from one Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. So with all respect, we just won't say Nurse Jillian all night. We'll just say Matt and Jill, if that's okay with you guys.
That sounds great.
Now, both Matt and Jill, you're both converts, and so before we get to the medicine that they're both on the front lines with this coronavirus, I'd like them to share just why they converted to Catholicism a few years ago. So, Jill, you and I have a common family, really good friends with in Washington, D.C. area, and Neil and Beth, I graduated university on the East Coast with them, and you were a caretaker for one of their children. I think if I'm remembering correctly, you caring for them was pretty central to you going from nothing to Catholic like 5-6 years ago. Am I in the right time period there?
So I met Beth and Neil when I started working for them, watching their children. And I had never actually met a couple that was happily married in my entire life. So, and Beth took me to what I know now was adoration. I didn't know where she was taking me. She was like, I'm just going to take you someplace. It's quiet. You can grieve. You can just, you know, sit and nobody's going to bother you. Because no one had a good answer of what I should be doing with all of my feelings.
What did you feel that first time in adoration? Not even knowing that was our Lord Jesus.
So I actually went to a really beautiful church and it was St. Mary's. So I have a very strong connection to our Holy Mother, because I don't have a mother myself. So when I was sitting there, it was actually an overwhelming feeling of being like hugged by your mother. So and I've told Beth this story actually, and I think after I told her, like, do you know what happened to me in adoration, I really felt like it was like physically being comforted, like somebody literally holding my shoulders. And that was like an overwhelming feeling. It really like snowballed from there into like RCIA. Like I had to know more. I started going, and then I was, you know, I had my baptism, first communion, confirmation, all in Easter. It was amazing. And like my life literally 180'd from that point on. I looked at myself where I was a year before and how unhappy I was, and I just lived for myself. You know, I was just like one of these millennials, just doing whatever they want, whatever feels good, whatever is new. Like that was what I did.
10 years before that, Beth bailed me out of a lot of pre-med studies. Her and Neil, I consider some of my best friends, and I know they'd be some of your best friends too. And then you and I got to know each other in D.C. because you were caring for one of their kids out there.
Right. So I lived with them for 5 years. But they've been my friend since like the early 2010s.
Did you become a nurse because Beth was a nurse, or did you already Was that your goal?
Basically, no, it wasn't. It was basically Beth. She's too humble to take any type of like accountability for it. She says, "No, you were born. Yeah, you were born for it. This is what I was like, absolutely not."
I think you were born for this, but she played a huge part in that.
Yeah, I think in the same way that people are born for it, but unless you have somebody kind of bolstering you up and like helping you find your own potential, like you're just going to be like, I was an idiot for I'm still kind of an idiot, but I had somebody who was at least in my corner saying like, you're really good at this. You can do this. You need to go and do it. And no one had really been that voice for me in my life until I had Beth. So
Jill, actually, we're going to keep this confidential for the podcast, but Jill works on, we'll just say this, one of the coasts. For the featured image of this podcast, I'm going to put up Georgetown Medical Center, but it's actually not there. I just figured, well, it's supposedly a Catholic place, and it's near where I met Jill and hung out with Beth and Neil. That's going to be the featured image, but we'll just say this. She's on one of the coasts. It's very prestigious medical place, and there's about 50 patients in her hospital with coronavirus, and she's taking care of some of them. So that's where Jillian's going to be a great resource for tonight. Dr. Matt, you are a convert also to the Catholic faith. Can you tell us just a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll try to give you the condensed version because that could be a long one.
Yeah.
So my wife and I got married young. We were, grew up kind of some stripe of evangelical Christian, both of us did, and kind of continue that faith through our early years in our marriage, and started having kids early on, and went to medical school with kids and residency, had more kids. And we ended up, by the time I finished my fellowship, we were on our sixth kid, which is a little bit unusual for most, evangelical Protestant families, but yep. we were doing the best we could and with what we had. And, but thank God that throughout those years, my wife had always had this proclivity for the Catholic Church. And as a literature major, a lot of great literature is Catholic, actually. And, I wasn't so much where she was at that point in terms of, I honestly thought a lot of it just didn't make sense, or it was just flat out, wrong. Mm-hmm. But what really brought us over the edge was, like so many people, what do you do after you have a bunch of kids, or maybe even two kids? Well, you have a vasectomy, right? Because mm-hmm. that's what people do. Mm-hmm. And certainly in the Protestant world, there's no teaching otherwise that there's anything wrong with that. So I did that. And, my wife had misgivings about it before I even had the procedure, but all the more after the fact, it was really like our marriage just kind of started spiraling down. Like there was just this major barrier now, and like something was just not right. And she knew that was what it was, and we weren't supposed to do that. And so all the more she started, reading the catechism and Catholic theology and the church fathers. And then she met you, actually, Father Dave, at a Planned Parenthood. She was outside praying. We'll get that straight. Not it.
Yeah. Every time I tell that story, Barry's always like, quickly. I was praying. Yeah. She always adds
right.
that.
Right. Exactly. So anyway, she told you our story, and that's how we met you, and you, came into our lives at that point. But very shortly thereafter, I ended up, we felt so compelled and just so, I think, led by the Spirit, really, that I needed to have this surgery. To have a reversal, and not because we wanted to have a lot more kids necessarily. We weren't even really thinking about that, but because we just felt that we did something grievous.
Which you
and
did,
because
you're up to how many now?
Well, nine. Nine, yeah. Yeah, that's a whole nother conversation.
God be praised. But, oh, that's great.
So anyway, so we did that, and around the same time started.
So the surgery worked.
So I did the reversal, and about the same time came into RCIA, and we knew that God was really calling us to this truth, and out of this kind of half truth of what much of the Protestant church believes, honestly, and a lot of arbitrary things that kind of follow from that. And I was actually baptized by you, as were a few of my kids, on Easter six years ago this year.
Okay. Yeah. I'll never forget that.
I know.
I had on one of those like 1970s Novus Ordo stoles, but still it was one of the best days of my life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, or ours too. I mean, it was,
yeah.
And then our lives have obviously continued to change, dramatically since that time. And,
yeah, you guys are great Catholics.
So grateful to God.
Didn't your friend, Troy played a big part in your conversion too, right?
He absolutely, I grew up in the Denver area, and, you know, I grew up in a Baptist church with Troy and his family, and Troy had a conversion long before mine, but he was my sponsor.
Yeah.
And great guy. So.
We had a podcast about a year ago, maybe 6 months, a year ago, at the Alexander House. And so any listeners out there who are kind of struggling with that decision can either contact Matt or the Alexander House does this full time, because their situation was even worse. And they're public about this. Also, this is a really neat conversion story, but it was their vasectomy removal that not only brought them into the Catholic Church, but actually saved their marriage as they were about to get a divorce. And then they had another 5 or 6 kids, and then now they're grandparents now. And it's amazing because it was like the scales fell from their eyes as soon as they had that reversal surgery. And now they're in the business of saving literally thousands of marriages, not just on that front, a lot of different fronts, but it was because they took her parents' advice to just give this a shot, because they knew everything was falling apart. So we had a whole podcast about 6 months ago to a year ago on that vasectomy removal. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, actually, the surgeon who performed that is in near Austin, Texas, and he is his kind of ministry, essentially, that he's a Catholic surgeon. And
yes,
Mark Hickman, I'll say his name.
Okay.
Amazing guy. And this is
they know Greg and Julie. This is Greg and Julie's whole ministry is out of San Antonio, but yeah, maybe I'll send you, if anyone writes me to get information, I'll either send them to you guys or to the Alexanders. But Matt, let's jump into coronavirus. Can you tell us just the basics of the difference between virus and bacteria, maybe the basics of this virus? You can get in contagion rates, how many patients are asymptomatic, the numbers projected, and the morbidity. And here's the thing, everybody listening. There are so many different numbers. These numbers are changing every day. That this we're recording this podcast on March 22nd. We're going to release it on March 26th. Everything's probably going to change in those 4 days. So we're just going to give you the basics we can here.
Yeah, absolutely. So my little disclaimer: I'm certainly not an infectious disease specialist. I mean, you know, most physicians aren't. I am at a specialty where I practice interventional spine and interventional orthopedic work. But with that said, I mean, I can certainly start with, you know, the basics. Well, you know, bacteria aren't all bad. Number one, we have bacteria in our bodies, in our guts. They're very important. For example, as part of our what we call microbiome or the gut flora, very important to have those bacteria. They're also single-cell living organisms, right? So they can live on their own and in a host, a multitude of environments. Obviously, some bacteria can kill us. Viruses, on the other hand, are not a single cell living organism. They are essentially kind of a clump of either DNA or RNA surrounded by a wall, a protein wall as such, and need a host to live. And so they are a pathogen. They make people sick. They make animals sick. What makes this particular coronavirus, and coronaviruses have been around for decades, it's just a description of kind of what they look like.
Mm-hmm.
But they're animal viruses, right? So humans aren't really exposed to these. And when they are, that's because of a mutation typically. And that's one of the things that when you get animal to human transmission, that's one thing. But when you get human to human transmission, that indicates further just potency or what we'd call virulence. And the ability to mutate. And that's the scary thing, is that humans really have not been exposed to this particular virus as we have with, say, influenza. People talk about, oh, there's so many more flu deaths. Well, it's true. There were, I think, 20,000 this recent flu season in the United States. That's a lot. I mean, we're up to not even nearly that amount in the United States right now. And I'm looking at Johns Hopkins website, which is really the most up to date. I mean, it's actually kind of like the war room, you know,
board
you can look at. It's coronavirus.jhu.edu. And, you know, they're showing total recovered, total deaths, total confirmed all over the world.
Excellent. I'll link that on this podcast
and
the blog post thing if you can. Yeah, we'll have that linked in.
Right. But So that's one thing people point out. Oh, not nearly as many people have died. And that's absolutely true. And I think the reality is, though, is that this is just highly much more contagious, a lot easier to transmit. Yep. And to the majority of people who have it, who aren't, you know, symptomatic, it doesn't seem like it's much of a big deal. But to those who are frail or elderly or have comorbidities, whether they're young or old, that's when it really becomes an issue. And it's becoming that.
And that would be immunocompromised children, too, right?
That's true. Now, the issue with kids is they don't have the receptor in their lungs to actually cause this. You know, this virus goes for the lungs, right? That's where these complications and disease come from. And the kids don't really have that. And I can't tell you exactly what age that's developed, but it's definitely later in life. And that's why we're just not really seeing sick kids unless there's really something.
Matt, are you talking about the ACE2 receptor?
I don't know the actual name of the receptor. That may very well be it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I mean, we're educating each other on this for sure. But anyway, immune compromised anybody, I think, is certainly at higher risk, but particularly, you know, adults.
Now, the last numbers I saw, 86% were asymptomatic, but again, it's a highly contagious disease.
Right.
Jill, tell us what you're finding. So Jill's really on the front lines in this hospital of treating coronavirus patients. And I think you said to me on the phone earlier today, Jill, you got 50 at your – they're not all in your unit, but there's 50 total at your hospital?
I mean, it's hard to say if they're confirmed, but because we're still waiting for – even if you're presumptive, like you're waiting for your test results to come back. So we presume you could have it. We have to place you on those precautions just to protect staff and to protect anyone else that you would come in contact with. So it's hard to say if those are confirmed cases or not.
What does the test look like? I saw them doing some type of nasal swab or mouth swab.
So I've seen a few different kinds. There's a nasal swab that has to go pretty far back there. But then there's also an oral swab. So the same idea, like back of your throat. I've also, or they can do like, I don't know if you're going to talk about the different type of intubation procedures, but they can do a bronchoscopy and get a sample as well.
That's pretty deep. Wow. I didn't know they had to go that far back.
Well, I think they were really trying to confirm. And so if you send three different samples and you have one that confirms and the other two don't, like you have a problem with your test.
Yep. Now, what's the deal with, you know, if this goes as big as people are projecting? I mean, I've seen numbers, and I got a lot of listeners out there in the traditional Latin mass world who think it's all phooey and all this stuff. But some of the more liberal media numbers are projecting as high as 25 million in California. But what's the deal as far as, like, does this country have enough test kits? And I think even the naysayers who think this is all, you know, even the conspiracy theorists listen who think it's just the government making this stuff up or a couple clicks behind that. It's pretty clear that testing is still something that has to happen because it's a real virus. Do we have enough test kits in this country?
I mean, if you're going to ask me personally as just a person, I would say no, because I mean, they don't want to test me.
Really?
No.
Even working in that hospital?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's why I think, you know, if you have 85%, or like you said, 85%, people are presumed positive, but like 85% of what number? Because they're not testing that many people.
Gotcha.
Because I think, number one, if we had the test, I don't know if we would want it to use them all in that way, because then you're really going to scare people when they find out that their teenage son is positive, you know, for COVID-19 and he has zero symptoms and he's been, you know, going to hang out with his friends, going to visit grandma, going back and forth from wherever. Yeah. Yeah, it's gonna scare people. So
let's say a couple clicks worse than asymptomatic. What are the mild symptoms that you're not going to see this in the ICU there? But what are the mild symptoms when you just start to present with some problems?
Flu-like symptoms, cough, runny nose, fever. When you're hitting a fever, they will test you. I think if you come into the ER and you're saying you're having a cough and you have a fever, you're going to get tested. Mild symptoms to not require testing, I would just say cough, runny nose, sore throat, flu-like symptoms, fatigue, body ache.
Yep. And I was talking to Beth today also about all this, and Beth's a nurse, and she was saying the only treatment you can really do at this point, or really even at the point of not even basically the whole nation, is a lot of fluids, a lot of electrolytes, and vitamin C. And even
it's
after
supportive.
You're supportive.
It's supportive therapy is what you can do with a virus and like let it run its course. Because even antivirals, like we don't have antivirals to treat this because it's so new. So the antivirals that they do have are ones that are being trialed right now, like in real time.
So let's talk about then once there's some moderate symptoms moving on to severe. You and I were talking earlier today, Jill, and this was the big shocker for me was, and I'm going to translate this into layman's terms, but Jill was telling me that as soon as this has moved into the lungs and there's just the smallest amount of respiratory distress, a lot of times they'll put someone on a nasal cannula. That's that funny thing that goes in the nose. It's a tube that goes in the nose and then around the ears. And they usually put it to 2, 3, 4 liters a minute of oxygen. And then, you know, more severe patients, whether that's trauma or medicine, they'll get what's called a non-rebreather mask, which sounds like a big deal, but it's just the oxygen mask that goes on the face. It's not the bag valve mask that where you're squeezing to breathe for somebody. It's just a mask on someone's face to give them a lot of oxygen that they turn up. I think, if I remember from my paramedic days, 10 to 15 liters a minute. And we would bring in serious patients with that. If someone had a femur fracture or a heart attack but was still breathing on their own, they would do that. And only when one of those patients, be it trauma or a heart attack, really deteriorated to the point of respiratory arrest, then on the ambulance we would do something called intubation. Intubation is when you put in a breathing tube, hook them up to the bag valve mask that you squeeze in your hand, and once you get to the hospital, that's hooked up to a ventilator. And basically, this is breathing for somebody. But usually for a normal medical or trauma patient, you kind of watch a progression of, at least if the person's slowly going downhill, they'll get a nasal cannula, then a non-rebreather mask, and then really when they're at the point of almost dying, you put them on an intubation tube and a ventilator. And again, this is not a fear-mongering podcast, but just so people understand the medicine of this, what's really surprising is Jill, who's on the front lines of this, was saying, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, if I got this wrong, but when someone's going from nasal cannula to need quite a bit more support on a non-rebreather mask, again, that's just the mask where they're still doing their own breathing, they're already hitting them with propofol, which is what makes you paralyzed, putting in a breathing tube, hooking them up to the ventilator, and essentially there's only two ways out of the ventilator. You either die or your system beats the virus on its own while receiving the breathing support of the ventilator. Is most of that correct right there?
Yeah, just two things. So propofol is not a paralytic. Propofol is a sedative.
Okay. What are they snowing them with then?
I just don't want people to be listening to this podcast and thinking like, oh my gosh, well, no wonder they can't breathe. You're just paralyzing people left and right.
Oh, right. Okay. Like,
it doesn't work. And then the non-rebreather, I would say by the time their oxygen requirements are hitting a very low amount, the physicians are already thinking like, we just need to get them intubated, because the longer you wait, they don't see improved outcomes the longer they wait to intubate them. So the best thing that I believe these physicians have seen through either their research or trial and error is that the faster you get them intubated, the faster you help support their respiratory system, the better chance that they're going to have.
So coronavirus is leading to bilateral pneumonia. Why aren't they able to beat this like a normal bilateral pneumonia? Or is this just the case for all ARDS situations?
Yeah, it does send the patient into severe ARDS.
Can you define that and tell people what that is?
So it's basically a complete I don't know. I'm going to fumble my way through this. So basically,
and Matt, you can jump in.
I'll give you.
Okay. It's the best way to describe it is a non-compliant lung. If you think about your lung as a balloon that you blow up, it's very easy to blow up a balloon. And imagine if you covered that balloon with super glue and let it harden and dry, and then you tried to blow it up. It wouldn't work. The lung doesn't work the way it should. And that's the damage that can be caused by ARDS and be caused by this virus in your lungs. So it's hard to ventilate a person using a ventilator machine when they're experiencing that type of trauma to their lungs. So all of the supportive therapy that we would use for somebody in ARDS, which is paralyzing them, basically making their body not fight the ventilator in any way. And those are pretty serious medications.
Matt, did you have anything to add to ARDS before?
Yeah, I was just going to add a little. I mean, that's a great explanation. I think it's
thanks, Matt.
Respiratory distress. Yeah. I mean, essentially, it's a massive inflammatory assault on the lungs, and it causes, you know, capillary permeability and leaking, and the lungs kind of get flooded. And their job is to exchange oxygen, which they can no longer do effectively. So you really can't even. Yeah, you can ventilate someone maybe, but you can't oxygenate them, and that becomes, and then you end up with multi-organ failure. And the other part of what happens in this kind of a severe pneumonia, say with corona or with other viral pneumonias, is you end up with secondary infections, what we call opportunistic infections, and your immune system's already taken a hit, so there's other stuff that's going to grow out of control. Hey, as well.
Jill, I think you're breathing into the microphone.
I'm so sorry. Oh my gosh, it sounds so creepy. Yeah, I'm sure.
I'll cut it out though. We can leave this for fun. Yeah, was that was that sound effects of COVID-19 right there or something?
No, I ventilator have no sound effects. Breath.
Exactly,
ventilator. I'm just fine.
So now, you mentioned the capillaries. Someone sent me a text yesterday where there's a lot of suctioning that's happening in these respiratory units. Are you doing a lot of that, Jill?
Okay, so I haven't really experienced maybe an overabundance, because when you think about a pneumonia, you think about like a wet lung. It has a lot, like you have the leaky capillaries, right? So so if you're listening to them, their breathing sounds really rattled. But sometimes the suctioning isn't helpful for that. Because the fluid isn't actually in their windpipe. You can't get it out. It's interstitial. You can't suction it out of them. Exactly. There's nothing you can do.
Yeah. So is this ARDS at the sort of moderate symptoms going to severe symptoms? Is this bilateral pneumonia hitting these COVID patients faster than a normal bilateral pneumonia/ARDS patient, or is this just pretty much par for the course and we're just bracing for COVID to be the cause of a ton of these?
Maybe that's hard. I know it did make sense to me. I just don't really know how to answer it if it's faster or more virulent. Mm-hmm. I think the scariest thing, which this is not the fear mongering podcast, but the scariest thing I think is just because it's unknown. We don't know. This isn't something that we've dealt with before. It's an unknown disease process. And you don't know how long you're going to need to support that patient. So that they can get over it themselves. And we're trialing these antivirals. We don't know what the effects of those are. So it's a lot of question marks. And Matt, you know, in the medical community, it's like question marks are great, but like maybe not when I'm having to deal with taking care of somebody, maybe on somebody else's time. But like, I want to know, I like data. I like facts. That makes me feel good. Question marks are a bit scary.
And Jill, before we get to Matt, I want you to just fill in anything else on the symptoms and the treatment that you're seeing in your patients. I really haven't given you a chance to say what you're doing all day in this hospital. So I'm just going to give you an open mic. Tell us about COVID-19 in your hospital.
I think for me, it's just when they transition to making the hospital no visitors, that was when it kind of hit home for me that we're locking down this hospital. The only people that are inside of it are patients and healthcare workers. There's a reason why family members need to stay with their families. They really take all of their empathy and they help them get better. And now they're not there to do that and to be with their family members. It really falls back on the nursing staff. And it's really hard. It's really hard to see patients. Maybe they don't even have, they're not even affected by this, you know, coronavirus. They have something else going on, but they could still potentially die in the hospital. And just what really hurts my heart is that if I'm not there, they could die alone without any of their family members.
You're saying not just the COVID patients, but your whole hospital is not locked visitors.
Yeah.
because of the coronavirus patients.
Exactly. Because we don't know, we don't want anybody to bring it in from the outside. Mm-hmm. And obviously everybody in the hospital is immunocompromised. They're there for a reason. They're not all healthy people filling the hallways. Like they're sick, they're dealing with their own illnesses. And the last thing we want to do is invite more infection into the hospital. So it's really sad.
Are they taking care of your personal protective equipment okay?
Yeah, I feel fine. I feel like a lot of other hospitals maybe aren't as equipped as mine. And that makes me scared, you know, for my coworker, you know, for my fellow nurses and respiratory therapists, physicians. Like, you know, if you only have one anesthesiologist in your hospital who's comfortable enough to intubate these patients, like, you need to have protective equipment for him, or else you don't have another one. There aren't, you know, we don't have like a stockpile of highly trained anesthesiologists to come and intubate everybody. Yep. You have to protect them. You have to protect your respiratory therapists and your nurses, because who else is going to, I mean, just like you have to protect your police officers, they don't have the equipment. That's if they're meeting somebody in the street, you know, who has coronavirus. And
I got in a little debate on my Facebook on National Guard coming in, because a guy with the Army who's very high in operations said, look, we'll bring in. He respectfully disagreed with me, because I put up a post saying, look, National Guard's not going to have like intubation tents and ventilation tents outside of hospitals if this goes bad. And he said, we have all these combat surgeons come in and stuff. I said, I totally bow to your operations understanding. But the fact is, they're simply not going to have the equipment. If this goes as big as people say, they're not going to have the equipment to tackle this, even if they bring in the most decorated combat surgeons. So I think a lot of people don't understand really what a last-ditch effort a ventilator is, and the fact that it's a $50,000 machine for those on respiratory arrest that are a few clicks from cardiac arrest. So this is where we have to hope this doesn't go big.
Absolutely.
So, Dr. Matt, you're in a unique situation because two of your partners got diagnosed, and you and your family of nine kids are feeling a bit sick. And I'll just put it bluntly, how sure are you that you have COVID-19?
Yeah. I think there's a good chance we have it. Talking to a lot of people in the field, my partners, a friend of mine who's an ER doctor at two really pretty busy hospitals, high volume hospitals up here. There's a good chance. I mean, I think the reality is a lot of us are going to end up with this, exposed to this, mildly sick, maybe not sick at all, and not get tested. I mean, you don't screen the general populace for something like this, just like you don't screen everybody for you know, other diseases that we encounter. So, with that said, as a physician, you know, do I get tested? And that's, you know, kind of the conundrum. Well, if you look at the CDC guidelines, you know, regardless, you basically need to be 7 days from symptom onset, before you kind of resume work. And if you have a fever, 72 hours of no fever, that's if you're not testing somebody. If you are, then you got to have two negative tests after that time period. And no one's going to do that, because they're just in our community. I can tell you, we have a pretty good sized community up here population wise, but the major health system has stopped testing for the virus in the community, because it's not indicated. There's just not enough of it. Aren't enough tests, I should say.
Now, and so, your two physician partners who did test positive, what are their symptoms?
So one of them, he was up in the mountains, which was kind of where this started in Colorado, as far as we know.
Yep.
And he just began feeling sick and lightheaded and nauseous and faint, and had some mild upper respiratory symptoms that persisted. The other one, he described more, you know, headaches and sinus type issues. Didn't feel terrible. I mean, for my part, you know, sore throat, a little bit of a cough. I feel better today than I did yesterday. I felt a little bit more lightheaded, maybe short of breath. But, you know, part of that also, I feel like, is maybe a little anxiety.
Sure.
Not really, you know, knowing, you know, everything about it. But so that's, you know, that's kind of where we're at. In terms of my family, everybody else is doing
it.
I mean, no one's really, really sick. You know, sure. I wouldn't be concerned.
Tell us about that med you're starting that everyone's been talking about a week or two.
Yeah. So, you know, really, really controversial right now. So hydroxychloroquine, So chloroquine is kind of the older drug, which was synthesized in the 50s, but really it comes from quinine. So quinine was discovered way back in like the 1630s, somewhere in Peru. And it was found to be have anti-malarial properties. And so they began work on that sometime in the 1800s. In the US in the 1950s, we actually saw anecdotal evidence. It had been used for malaria prior to that, but for autoimmune disease, in the form of what we call Plaquenil, or hydroxychloroquine is the generic name for that. So in China and South Korea, several weeks ago, they began, and I'm really not even sure what the impetus was to start looking at this. But they started putting people on this that were, you know, fairly sick and able to take it. And the preliminary data looked good enough to where they put it in their treatment guidelines. And they, you know, they're very specific of in terms of when do you start this. And so there's been several, you know, small studies published mostly in infectious disease journals, which are, you know, you get 20 patients or something kind of studies. These are not studies with hundreds or thousands of patients. The most recent one was one that came out in from France, I think today or yesterday, and that even involved the use of, do you remember the drug, the Z-Pak, everybody used to take for,
sure.
We joke about that for, you take that for a virus because it didn't really cover much in terms of bacteria because it was so overly used, but anyway, there might be some synergy in taking both of those. And so my wife has rheumatoid arthritis, and she's been on hydroxychloroquine for quite a while, actually. We know it's a well-tolerated drug, so the safety profile's there. And it's been used for decades, so there's a lot of experience with it.
Listeners out there who don't have a huge medical background, this medicine will not eradicate the virus, but it will decrease the symptoms, right?
So that's a good question. So it's not an antiviral drug. It's not an antibiotic. It's not an antibacterial drug. Essentially, it alters the immune system. And actually, it's quite complex when you start reading about what the specific effects are. But it's an immune modulator, right? So it's allowing your body to not go into this massive immune collapse and have what we call cytokine storm. And in many ways, as it works for rheumatological autoimmune diseases, that's probably how it's helping people with this disease. But what the preliminary data shows is that it shortens the course and it shortens the viral load. When they actually measure how much viral burden or viral particles someone has on board, it's actually reducing that, you know, after maybe 6 days. I'll say this, the media and especially the president have really run away with this as this is going to be the next greatest, medical breakthrough. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know that that's going to be the case. Sure. I think we need data and we're going to look back after a year and maybe we'll have treated hundreds of patients with this regimen at that point. We can make a little bit more definitive, kind of statement on that and have more guidance. But,
are there people taking the president's lead and basically trying to make this a preemptive thing? Everyone's probably taking it off the, whatever.
That's a good question. I mean, it doesn't have an FDA indication for this, which doesn't necessarily, I mean, we use off-label, you know, drugs quite a bit, as long as we, at our discretion, can justify their safety and efficacy, right? So if you can do that with this drug, I don't see any reason why you shouldn't or couldn't take it necessarily. I just think it is a little early, and the data is definitely not there to say this is going to be the miracle, Corona Buster type of a drug. Because I don't know that's going to bear out in the literature. It might, but we don't know.
Hey, Jillian, tell me that story you told me about that Filipino family today. If you can repeat that for our listeners.
Let's see. So this was when we had just the news is always changing, right? At the hospital level,
every day.
It's every single day. There's a new protocol for something. There's a new process for something. We're all just trying to figure it out as we go along. And this is when we found out on Sunday that the hospital was going to be going no visitors. Mm-hmm. And that was going to start Monday morning. So I was taking care of someone who I knew that they were Catholic. They were listening to mass on their iPad. Mm-hmm. And I said, has anybody contacted spiritual care for you?
has she had a priest come visit her? Has anybody come to visit you? And she said, no. And I said, okay, so I'm going to call. I have
and this
to call,
is a COVID,
the after
is a coronavirus
hour.
Patient?
No.
Okay.
I'm still in the ICU. These are still very sick people.
Sure.
But I said, let me call spiritual care. And what happens is after hours, I don't know if I'm going to get a priest. But somehow, some way, I always get a priest when I need one. I don't know
why.
I don't know how they
know. That's because you're aggressive on this
stuff.
Dude,
I'm so aggressive. I'm so... And they always they show up.
Yeah, they know it's you.
No, they don't necessarily know it's me, but we have like this really amazing like African priest who comes, and he's just like has the thickest accent. I love him so much, and he just douses the room in holy water. Sweet. And I'm all about it.
But see, this is important for listeners. I mean, I think probably most of my listeners who are in healthcare, they're going to be smart enough to call a priest. But I think a lot of people out there, especially non-Catholic nurses, you know, someone asks for a priest and they might just call, as you said, spiritual care. And then a Lutheran deaconette or someone shows up and, you know.
Or a Buddhist. We have Buddhist monks. You know, you don't know who's going to come. But I can request, you know, on Monday through Friday and their regular hours, I can request a priest to come.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. And I was actually there for the next day when the priest was there. And at this point, there's no visitors allowed. And so I believe it was the case manager or somebody else from spiritual care FaceTimed the family while the priest was doing his anointing of the sick.
Yeah.
And it was so awesome. I was so glad that they were there, but also I was glad that I was there as well to like kind of see this through and make sure that it happened. That, you know, aggressive Catholic nurse style. Like, I'm going to make sure if you want a priest, I'm going to make sure one at least knows that you're here.
Once I told Jillian about 5 years ago on the phone that in a life or death situation, anybody can baptize. And Jill went overboard and you started flying with holy water, I think.
I don't think it's over. Like, what's overboard about that?
No, I'm sorry. I take that back. It's not overboard, but just the expectation that a plane's going to go down is overboard. Not hoping to baptize people.
Father, I always go to confession before I get on a plane. I want you to know. That's like a must fly for me. That's like, oh, do you have your breath mints? Your travel pillow? Like, oh, no, I need to go to confession. What else do I need? A giant water bottle that's overpriced, but it's okay because I'm going to save everyone on the plane. Like, they're all coming with me.
You know, I got a cool story. I was actually in the Madrid airport, a huge terminal, and for some reason there wasn't a lot of people around, even though this is a big airport. And I ran into – I was in my Roman collar. I see another guy in a Roman collar, and he doesn't look exactly Spanish. We start speaking Spanish, and it turns out he's from Central or South America. I ask him to go to confession. I hand him my stole. Then he has to go, and he hands me the stole back. We confess each other. We went our ways, and I'll never see him again till, please God, heaven. Right in the airport.
That's great.
Not cool?
Was that a Camino trip for the day?
That was actually at the end of your and my Camino. Uh-huh. You guys had flown back, and this was at the very end, because I always like to go right before I fly, too, and this was literally right before I flew, like an hour. But see, this is an important point, Jill, on the baptism, because all these dioceses are getting creative on the Eucharist, but I think people need to get creative on repentance. This was two podcasts ago. I called it the ABCs of end-of-life care. Ask them if they'll accept Jesus as A. B, baptize them if they're not baptized. C, hear their confession. This was specifically to priests. But lay people out there can do A and B. So if there's healthcare workers out there, you need to be thinking, if someone's approaching death and you can't get a priest – you need to – this is going to sound Protestant, but this is right out of the Council of Trent. Ask them if they will accept Jesus as their Savior. Don't downplay the amount of grace that God pours out at the last minute. Many people will say yes. And just as Jillian, as a young Catholic 5 years ago, was ready to baptize as many people on a plane going down as possible, healthcare workers out there, if these hospitals are going lockdown and people aren't as aggressive as Jill as being able to get a priest in there – then, well, I guess anybody who's going to be aggressive enough to baptize is also aggressive enough to get a priest. But the fact is, the fact is that all the healthcare workers out there who are Catholic need to stop just thinking about, you know, how they can receive the Eucharist. I mean, that's super important. I pray that all you lay people can get back to Mass. But the healthcare workers need to also be thinking not just to themselves and the sacraments, but that Jesus died for billions of unbaptized people out there. And again, if this goes big, you can baptize them, folks. You can baptize them. You can call them to repentance. You can say, you're going to spend eternity in heaven or hell. Do you want Jesus to wash away all your sins through my hands right now? A lot of people will be given the grace to say yes. And this is a unique time, especially if they're locking down hospitals without visitors. I don't mean find easy targets and manipulate them when their families aren't around. But there is a grace that can come into people's lives when they don't have family pressure. Of course, we don't want to baptize if they're not awake and alert, at least blinking that they want to accept Jesus. But really, healthcare workers out there can do that. And Jill, I don't think most of our listeners really understand how serious it is to say a hospital can't have visitors. Do you want to maybe highlight why that's so jarring for you right now?
I mean, I think when I first heard that we were going to be doing this, honestly, and I feel like I can be honest with you. I feel like it's actually I'm supposed to be honest with you, is that I was like, yes, this makes my job so easy because I don't have to cater to families.
Sure.
Particularly when I'm taking care of, you know, and that it's not doesn't mean catering like, you know, fetch me some water, although I am asked to go get water for people's family members. And that's fine. That's my job, too. But also it just helps me be able to focus on the patient, which is my primary, that's what I'm there for. So honestly, I was first like, wow, this is great. There's no traffic anymore. And now there's no family members. And then that really started to hit home for me about like, I don't know, midnight or one, you know, people were leaving. And like I said, we have very sick patients in the ICU. And just realizing that I'm just going to have to call them and tell them over the phone. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I'm taking all of this grief onto myself. I have to be there. And somebody asked me, it was actually a family member that asked me, like, are you trying to tell me that if you're doing chest compressions, like on my, you know, loved one, that I can't come back here? And I was like, I mean, that's what they're telling me. I'm sorry. Yeah. There's nothing. I mean, I'm just being told what I'm supposed to tell you.
And that's where this is, again, I guess it is a fear-mongering podcast. If we've now had three disclaimers saying it's not a fear-mongering podcast, but
I'm sorry.
No, it's not. Because the next thing I want to say to people is, if you go in, you should say your goodbyes to family. Again, most people are going to come out fine. But if they're locking hospitals down, it's good to have confessed to a priest before you go in there for the Catholics. And it's good to give a hug and kiss to your families. I'm not saying it means you're going to die in there if you have COVID-19, but you have to plan on a different type of hospital stay than you would in this country in 2019, right?
I mean, I don't know how long this is going to last. Like, that's the thing. Like, nobody knows. Nobody knows how long this is going to last. Nobody knows how long they're going to keep the kids home from school or keep the hospital locks down. Nobody knows. But for right now, this is how it is.
So let's just do a speed round real quick. We're going to finish up the podcast. You guys can disagree. This is the speed round. And you've each got 20 to 30 seconds to give your opinion on some controversial topics on COVID. And you can disagree with each other. Okay. Dr. Matt, is it going big, yes or no?
I mean, I think it's already big in the sense that when you have no masks and you have no school and most people aren't going to work, I think it's big in that sense. Is it going to kill a lot of people off in this country? No, I don't think so. I think a lot of people are going to be asymptomatic and be carriers, and that may be part of the problem because they may end up getting a lot of other people sick. But no, I think we're going to beat this, and I think we're going to recover and learn a lot of lessons.
Nurse Jillian, he's going big.
Oh my gosh. Matt, why did you set me up like that? So the thing about America is we do have a lot of comorbidities. It's everyone is on blood pressure medication. Everyone has diabetes. And that's a scary thing for me.
We're a sick country.
Dang, Matt. Like, really? You're just like, no, we're going to be fine. I'm like, no, we're not.
I told you guys you can disagree with each other before.
I know, but I feel like the fear. Anyway, go ahead, Father. You have more things to ask.
Is that your answer?
Yes.
Going big. Okay.
Yeah.
Social distancing. How important is it, doctor?
I think that's the key. I think there's a lot of I say us, but younger people that are running around with this. And I think that's going to be the key right now to really keep it from going big if it does. And keep those who are really at risk away from this. And that's going to be the key, is getting the people that are carrying this around to really stay away from everybody else. And that's so I think that's really critically important at this point.
Nurse Fearmonger? I mean, Nurse Jillian?
Nurse, 100%. I agree with that. And I just want you to know, like, I don't have symptoms. I'm going to work, but I don't go anywhere else. I go to work. I go home.
Now, you did have a quick funny story, though, about some family coming from rural to urban. And we won't, again, we're keeping where she is off the podcast, but it's a super famous hospital. Anybody would know internationally.
Oh my gosh,
am I giving too much information? All right, sorry. I'm not even saying where it is.
So we're being really vague, except where it's a really big hospital. You would definitely know
it. It's super important.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, but
anyway,
you have families come from rural
nobody listens to
urban.
To me. Yeah, in my family.
You told
them
not to come.
Absolutely. I'm like, you are in the best place in your town, in your area where you are. They have zero. Nobody has it. Hmm. You need to lock that city down. Keep everybody out.
But behind this, I have a serious question. Are you saying it's safer rural than urban?
I mean, I live in a big city. I think about that all the time. Like, do I need to send my husband and my kids away? I don't know. I thought about that a few weeks ago when it was starting to come over. And we're seeing, you know, we started to get patients with it. I don't know if we were one of the first hospitals to get patients with it, but I called my husband when I was at work and I was like, I think you need to go take the kids and stay with your mom. Like, or I need to go stay at a hotel. Like, it's just because we don't know.
Yeah.
And my primary, like my kids didn't sign up for me to be a nurse. I signed up to be a nurse.
Mm.
So just the lack of information. I want to protect my kids and I want to protect my family. I think that's what everybody wants. So just like stay at home for a little bit.
Can I say the first letter of the name of the hospital?
No. Oh my.
Just kidding.
Now
I'm
you're
just kidding. All right. Next. All right. Next question is,
I'm never doing a podcast with you again. You're going to get me fired.
Not going to get fired. Nobody listens to this podcast anyway. You got even the two of you listen to my friend's podcast, Catholic Stuff You Should Know, and don't even listen to mine. So Jillian's on one of the coasts and she's known me for 7 years and she listens to my friends, but no one listens.
I think that speaks to actually your ability to like get yourself out there. If not,
what a better time
like your advertising.
Exactly. Well, they've dropped my name a few times. So God bless
them. They have. They're
good guys. Okay. Yeah. Next question. Military shutdowns and quarantines. Dr. Matt, what's your thoughts? Is it going to happen?
Well, I mean, it's happening. I mean, we're in Colorado where we are. The governor just basically said non-essential businesses need to reduce their staff by 50%. I mean, that's hardly a draconian sort of military presence, but
sure,
you know, like you showed pictures the other day from Baltimore with the National Guard. I really think in the bigger cities, in the higher crime cities, where there's just more propensity to have looting and rioting and antisocial behavior, I think it's more of a protection. I don't think this is like a government takeover. I live in more of a rural-ish area. I don't really see it happening that way.
Mm-hmm. Nurse Jill, military shutdowns and quarantines.
You know, I don't know. I feel like I know nothing. I don't know enough about this. So
you're in a liberal state, and I'm not teasing you. This one, you're in a liberal state.
Well,
and
now they definitely know where I am.
No, they don't. There's Massachusetts. There's which maybe you're in, and maybe you're not. but really, the liberal states, I think there's a bigger danger of some shutdowns, right?
Yeah, I mean. Yes, I feel like all of the businesses are basically closed around me anyway.
Yeah.
So I don't know what else they can do. And they're going to have checkpoints on the freeway. I ask you where you're going. I really don't know.
What worries me, obviously, and I don't know the first thing about economics is, what happens when all the people getting paid $10 an hour in this country still don't have a job in a month, six mm-hmm. weeks. They haven't had an income. Is there going to be riots at that point? I mean, it seems like every day of this is going to have a month of economic ramifications and every week is going to have half a year of economic ramifications. So that's what worries me on this whole thing is, I mean, I'm
as
never.
As long as they can get their unemployment check, like seriously, as long as they can get their unemployment so that they can, you know, DoorDash food and go, you know, buy diapers for their family. You know, if they live in a state where weed is legal, as long as they can get that, like everybody's going to stay where they're supposed to stay.
But you're like, totally giving away a lot more about
there's so many
than I
of those. Now.
I didn't say that that's where I lived. I'm just saying that's what keeps people happy. As long as they have their Wi-Fi, their video games, like then they're going to stay inside and they're going to stay compliant. But once those things start to break down, like their comfort ability, like their comfort level starts to break down, I think that's when you're going to have like the need for the National Guard.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's right. Last speed round is economy. I kind of just touched on it myself. Matt, what do you think about how is this going to have affect the economy? Even if it doesn't go big, how will it affect the economy?
Well, I mean, it has gone big in terms of economics already. I mean, we're not quite to 2000 where the market lost 80%, but you know, we're moving in that direction. I think the problem is for small businesses and ours included, you know, I'm in a private practice.
Yeah.
That's not a particularly big practice. Is you really can only go so long without an income. You know, you can lay off your employees or whatnot, but you know, if we're not showing up to work and providing goods and services, or people aren't purchasing those or whatever, then businesses close down and they may not come back from that. So, I think the big corporations are going to be fine. And that's, it's actually kind of sad because this country's moved, I think, in a direction away from mom and pop types of businesses anyhow, progressively. And I think that's really detrimental, but it's going to have lingering effects. Are we going to rebound? Yeah, I think so. You know, it certainly is going to test our comfort, I think. And I hope just drive us more to be all the more reliant upon God and that he gives us what we need every day.
And I have to say, you know, in some sense, if you look at the history of Israel, what Israel needs is actually a full bottoming out to return to God.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and I'm not saying you're wrong what you said, because I'm not, Kevin Williams, our common friend, sent me that Amos 5:18 that basically said, you should not want the day of the Lord. It's going to be darkness. It's going to be, you know, as it says in Hebrews, the trumpets and the doom and the darkness. So I don't think, you know, I have to pull away from that edge of saying, just, you know, bring the wrath of God here, because it's going to be really bad. But probably more people go to heaven in those situations, because when you don't have, as Jill said, your Wi-Fi and your weed, you either turn to like Superdome Katrina killing people, or you turn to God, as people kind of did very, very, very briefly at 9/11. And so I hate to say it, because I think maybe Calvinists might talk like this or something, but a total crisis or chastisement could be what returns us to God and restores the church. But again, this is the mystery of this COVID-19. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. Jill, thoughts on the economy?
I'm going to defer to Matt. That was such a great answer.
Okay. Oh, that's good enough.
I can't talk about things that I don't know. I can't talk about, I have no clue. I don't know. I'm glad I get to still go to work. That makes me happy.
I think the reality is we're all still comfortable right now. We have our houses and we have food and we're just staying inside more, and maybe we're not going anywhere, and so it's not near that level where people are starting to to worry about where, you know, how they're going to feed their families. But at the same time, I'll just say that this is really, from our family standpoint, really caused a step up in the domestic church, because it's really easy to, I think, ignore that and get really busy with life and running kids around to school and sports and whatnot, and we just forget about these things. And
what do you mean by that? How is it cause an increase in the domestic church?
So we're, as a family, we're praying more than we ever have, you know, and we've always talked about, we need to do this. We need to do the family rosary every day. And we've just always, you know, found excuses not to do it. I'm embarrassed to say so, but we're doing it now, and we're getting up and doing morning prayer, and we're just, you know, and I'm not saying that to say, oh, you know, I'm, you know, such a good spiritual leader. I'm not. It's just that this is like really causing us to realize what's important. And
praise
and
God,
that's,
man,
really what it is.
Awesome.
At the end of the day.
Good for you. Well, I'll just ask my listeners then to pray for Dr. Matt's family as they're approaching some rule out COVID-19 diagnoses and some different symptoms. And I'm going to ask my listeners to pray for Jill, who's really on the front lines. And in a certain sense, putting her life on the line and her family, her family's life on the line for facing this disease. I don't know if it's an endemic or a full pandemic yet, but she is facing a dangerous disease. And so I'd ask my listeners to pray for her. So anything else y'all want to add to our podcast today?
Thank you for what you're doing, Jill. I mean, you are on the front lines. I can hardly go to work at this point, except for very emergent, critical types of cases, which there aren't many of in my line of work. So thank you for what you do. I mean, it's amazing.
Oh my gosh, you're so sweet. That's very kind. Thank you. I like being a nurse is like what I'm supposed to do. That's where I'm supposed to be. I really wouldn't have it any other way. Father David knows, like you have your same background as a paramedic. Like, don't you think the same way? Like when you see a car accident, like your first response is to stop and see if everybody's okay. that's how I feel. So I wouldn't have it any other way. I like to be there. I like to be the one taking kind of control and like trying to help people.
That's right. And I'm glad you're on the front line. So, and thank you both for just saying yes to your vocations in family life and medicine. God bless you guys.
Absolutely. Thanks, Dave.